I wanted to just recap briefly what we were covering last week and then just finish up this discussion about DNA forensics. And then we'll go on to the next topic. So recall that on Thursday, I just described to you how information is encoded in the genome and that how specific signatures in the genome can be used to assess whether or not you're related to somebody else. And that's by basically determining whether or not in your genome you have a particular set of alleles at a number of different locations in your DNA. And recall that this figure is just a panel of two gels in which the different locations in the genome are assayed by a PCR-based method in which you count up the number of repeats in a DNA sequence. And typically, you would have two pairs of repeats, one that you got from your mother and one that you got from your father. And in some cases, if you see one repeat shown, that's because in that instance, those repeats, the same number of repeats were inherited from your parents. So the technology for DNA forensics is basically to determine a DNA fingerprint based on the repeats that are at different loci in your genome. And the accuracy of determining whether your fingerprint, DNA fingerprint, matches with somebody else is a function of how many different loci you assay at. So the name of the game in the end becomes how do you size DNA in a way that's accurate and also turns out fast. And so I left with this equation, which basically tells you that the ability to resolve any two repeats, that is two lengths of DNA which are different by four bases, is a function of something about the gel itself, either the material and how well it's able to select or interact between with DNA strands, also with the length of the gel. The longer a gel has in contact with a piece of DNA, generally, the better you are able to resolve one piece of DNA from the other. And then factors which broaden the band, so either time or diffusion, which in this term includes the temperature at which you do the assay. So if you want to improve resolution, then you either change the gel, you make the gel longer, or you minimize the effects from either how you inject the sample into the gel or how you control diffusion and broadbanding. So instead of running these DNA fragments on a slab of acrylamide or agarose or some sort of monolithic 2D sheet of gel, the latest configuration in DNA analysis is based on MEMS. Okay, so MEMS is the anachronism for microelectromechanical systems. But in this case, instead of an electronic design, we have a design for biology. So instead of wires, you have channels. Instead of electrons flowing through wires, you have DNA or protein flowing down channels. Okay, so the analogy is directly the same. And the formats are shown here. So in this chip, and notice that the scale here is 1 centimeter, you have areas where you inject, you load your DNA sample. These are the lanes in which the DNA is resolved. There's a waste reservoir. And somewhere down here, you're scanning across all 8 lanes in this particular configuration to detect the pieces of DNA as they come by. So just to give you a sense of performance, these are 2 alleles at 4 different loci. separated on a slab gel like the one you just saw two slides ago. And so you see, you know, these two alleles are well resolved and so on. And the time it took for this band to pass or to resolve on the gel was approximately a couple hours. Currently, most DNA testing is done not on slabs of gels, but on fine capillaries, glass capillaries, which are filled with gels. So now we've basically eliminated all the extraneous gel and now inject DNA into the capillary. And the capillary contains the sample. And so you see, again, these two same four sets of alleles now separated in a capillary system. And now the time scale here is less than an hour. Okay, so there's a significant improvement in speed or performance without sacrificing resolution. Notice that one difference is that signal to noise is poorer here than in the slab gel, but it's still acceptable because you can still see the peaks. In contrast, let's compare the performance where you inject these same set of four alleles, loci, on one of these microchips, where now the time scale is on the order of a couple minutes. And you can see that you can resolve both of these alleles just as well as you can on a slab gel. But again, now the time dimension is minutes rather than hours. So we've improved performance in a log scale rather than in at a linear scale. So anytime you achieve log scale gains in performance for whatever metric you are measuring, it's a real win. Now, these little peaks here are actually the DNA ladders that are co-injected with the sample. So it gives you actually a better sense of how well these microchips can work in resolving the different DNA fragments than what you might see in these other systems. So the take-home message is maybe these microfabricated formats are better than current technology. How do they work? Well, remember I said that we have channels etched in glass through standard photolithography methods. So if you take the FAB course over in the Stata Center, then in Building 38, then you'll be able to fashion one of these devices. You have a well that's etched in glass. You have a T configuration in which you have a separation channel, and across it is designed a sample loading well and a waste exit well. So you load your sample, you fill these channels with gel. You load your sample in this well. You electrophorese or pull the DNA across that channel by setting up an electric field. And then when this intersection is filled with DNA, you change the polarities on the ends of the channel, and you pull back the DNA samples in the wings, and you launch this plug of DNA down the separation channel. And then as the sample is sized through the gel, you separate the different DNA fragments, and then you detect them as they go past a point at the end of the channel. Okay. Now, I told you something about factors that affect resolution. This is just a time-lapse movie where we're imaging the injector, it filled with DNA to the sample, and now we're switching the polarity and we're looking, this is fluorescently labeled DNA, and so you're seeing the DNA as it's being launched down the separation channel. Notice that the DNA is getting concentrated as it starts to initiate its separation. So this concentration factor is one of the reasons why the resolution is much better in this format, because there's a change in not only the polarity on the gel, but it turns out there's buffer and ion gradients that are also set up, which help you resolve these pieces of DNA because you concentrate them in a much narrower band. Okay, so that's where you gain on one part of the equation. You can run these gels longer, or you can run these fragments through longer and longer channels. Obviously, you'll be able to resolve them better. But we saw that even for very short channels, we have adequate resolution. So here, length is actually not as a main consideration. In fact, the short length is also an advantage, because the shorter the lane, the faster the run is accomplished. So you can analyze samples much more quickly, as you saw in these short microfabricated formats, than in these long slab gels. The other reason is that because these channels are only on the order of 100 microns wide and 40 microns deep, whatever heat is generated is rapidly dissipated. So again, that diffusion broadening parameter is minimized in this format than compared to the other formats. And then this just shows that something that we saw in the other figure, which is that we can analyze or multiplex the analysis of several of these loci at once in the same injection. So we can resolve all of these different alleles in these four different loci. And then by looking with a scanner at different wavelengths and injecting samples that are made with different color primers, we can then multiplex additional loci by including color as the additional variable or parameter. Okay, so you can see how we can, in one single device, improve on the speed and of the DNA detection and resolution without sacrificing resolution. And that's basically the basis for Sorry, I can't talk and do my PowerPoints at the same time here. And that's the basis for what we think will be how we're going to be able to genotype DNA in the future. Devices based on the ones I've shown you are now in test, where the forensics units are put them into a van, bringing them out to the field, and are actually testing DNA samples at the field. So I think my goal is maybe I want to be on this TV show, CSI, as, you know, sort of maybe the geeky technician that does a DNA test. Okay, any questions about what we just covered over the last couple days? If you have questions, you know, feel free to. This is a seminar. So seminars, by definition, are not lectures, although they probably seem like they are. So if you really do have questions, please feel free to interrupt. This is really to help give you some background information about the basis for bioengineering. OK, what I want to do now is to switch to a related topic about how information is encoded in the genome. But instead of talking about information as in the strictest sense of sequence of DNA, let's go up one level or two levels of complexity in biological structure and talk about how function is encoded in the genome. Okay? So it's easy to understand that the genome is a linear sequence of DNA bases. But then how do you go from that information, which is basically a parts list of the different proteins that are synthesized in a cell, to including the instruction set that tells those proteins what to do, right? There's no other information that's encoded in the genome, in other parts of the genome, that says this protein, you know, carries out this catalytic reaction. It's all intrinsic to the DNA sequence of that protein. So what we'll do is I'll cover two important concepts understanding biological structure, which is that there's basically two ways of building up structure. Either you do it by chemistry, i.e. making covalent bonds, or by self-assembly. And self-assembly is through interactions by ionic forces or attractions or repulsions, van der Waals interactions, and hydrophobic interactions. And it's those three sets of interactions that really are responsible for higher order structure from the protein level up. And then what I'll do is I'll show you an example in which self-assembly is responsible for generating force and organizing, in this case, the genome in daughter cells during mitosis. And we'll talk about a little bit about the machinery, the protein machinery, that the cell constructs transiently in order to separate and partition the genome in chromosomes. And then we'll talk about how that dynamics is the important target for anti-cancer drugs. And then we'll go into a little bit about some aspects of what we know and think about anti-tumor drugs. Now, there's a reading if you want to get a better overview of this whole area. And it's an excellent review in Nature Reviews in Cancer by Mary Ann Jordan and Les Wilson, who are at University of Santa Barbara. Okay, now, let's go back. We have genes. They encode a linear sequence of DNA. And in the end, what those genes represent is the machinery that executes whatever the information is in the genome to make a cell and carry out the functions of a cell. To get to here from the DNA, we have to go through an intermediate step in which the four-letter DNA code is translated into a 20-letter or more amino acid code. And you know, this whole area encompasses in 701 and in 703 and 705 and 706 all of transcription, regulation of gene expression, and protein synthesis. Okay, so in bioengineering, we've managed to compress that down to 1 minute or 2 minutes. Now, this 20-letter code is just the linear sequence of amino acids, but it's important that we understand how the execution of function is carried out by this machinery, and it's all involves self-assembly, as I alluded to earlier, and it has to do with how that linear string of DNA, or protein, sorry, folds up. So again, this is just basic biological structure. You have the amino acids here represented in one-letter code. It's a one-to-one correspondence between an amino acid and three bases in the DNA sequence, so the codons to amino acid. But what happens next is that each amino acid has a particular chemical characteristic, either hydrophobic or hydrophilic. It's charged or polar, nonpolar, whatever, okay? And it's those characteristics or properties of amino acids where in their local environment, they dictate how this amino acid will interact with the amino acids around it. And so what you find is that the linear sequence of amino acids in a polypeptide fold locally into a secondary level of structure. So sometimes the amino acids, if they are able to interact with each other, will collapse not into a string of, the string of amino acids will collapse into a coil. Okay. Or you'll have a string of amino acids that will be arranged as a short straight sheet or a short straight strand of protein. And so if you look at the linear sequence and map onto it in the protein structure, what are the secondary, how the protein sequence is organized in secondary structure, you have these regions in which you have local folds of helices and strands. Now, that doesn't tell you how the protein works. It just tells you how the protein is organized at this local level. Now, just as amino acids interact with each other to give you these local organized bits of polypeptide, then it's also true that these structures, they have also chemical characteristics. They interact with the surrounding amino acids. And you can see how you get bits or parts of protein folding up on itself from these local folds. And in fact, if you look at the structure of a protein, and I forgot actually which one this one is, you can see that In this case, the structure was determined by X-ray crystallography. And you can see that you have the polypeptide chain starting here, meanders around. Let's see. It goes someplace here. Anyway, it comes around in strands. These strands form part of a sheet. Then you have a helix that's rather long. Oh, actually, I missed out someplace. The N-terminus goes this way, this way, this way, this way. So you have four strands in a sheet. Then you have a long helix. And then now you have these four sheets or strands and then this long helix. So there's actually like a twofold axis of symmetry described in the structure. It's formed these four strands, and these four strands are contiguous in space, but they're actually discontiguous in sequence. But they form the floor over which is overlaid two helices. And so you can imagine that this forms a binding pocket for something else. Okay, so that's just an illustration of how locally folded elements, when organized into three dimensions, collapse into a compact structure in which they're connected by loops or turns. There's other parts of the sequence which have no defined or apparent regular structure to them. But that's basically the elements that give rise to a folded protein. Proteins can be all helical. They can be all sheet. They can be a combination of the two. They can have a lot of random structure. Depends on the sequence. Depends actually on the context of the sequence. Okay. Now, so the process then is, how does a polypeptide chain end up in a native folded structure? And so what I just described to you was that elements of local sequence will fold up into something that's semi-ordered. So we call that a Mohton globule. Other parts will fold up sometimes into local folds as well, and that these will coalesce into the final native structure. Now, a curious thing is that if you look at all the permutations of how a protein can fold up based on the flexibility of the bonds that link individual amino acids, it should take a long time. But obviously, proteins fold much faster than that. So there must be pathways through this complexity in various states of fold and unfold of proteins so that the protein typically folds in a matter of a minute or so in the test tube. And in a cell, actually, it's even faster than that. So what is it? What's responsible for getting proteins to fold faster? And generally, you can understand that as proteins get bigger and bigger and bigger, then how do different parts find each other? Folding must be intrinsically more difficult for things that are big than things that are small. And the answer is that in the last decade or so, we found that there are proteins, machines, called chaperones and chaperonins, which are large macromolecular structures, on the order of ribosomes or larger, which take the polypeptide chain as they come out of the ribosome and bind to the polypeptide chain, preventing the polypeptide chain from folding in an indiscriminate manner as it's being synthesized, so that when the polypeptide chain is being synthesized, you get discrete steps in folding of the protein to its properly folded state. Or alternatively, the protein as it's being synthesized is then helped in its folding by these large macromolecular complexes, and then folded properly within these protein machines. So it's the machinery that the cell has which allows protein synthesis to occur in a relatively error-free manner. OK, so we've gone now from linear sequence in amino acids to local folds. But that's not function, right? If you look at whether or not this protein can carry out its function, whether it's an enzyme to catalyze a chemical reaction or some protein that's designed to bind something, it's probably not going to happen. It's only after the entire polypeptide chain has folded in its correct configuration. And so it's in that three-dimensional context of the structure that the protein is able to execute what it was designed to do. And so function is something that's encoded in three-dimensional structure, but the three-dimensional structure in turn is a consequence of the linear sequence of amino acids. So you can see then how the DNA sequence and a protein sequence, which I refer to as hardwired instructions, then give rise to these other higher order functions that aren't hardwired but come out as a consequence of how those instructions or how those amino acids fold up. So function requires correct folding and self-assembly of parts of amino acids into a protein. Okay, now let's take that concept of self-assembly. So these are, again, local interactions, electrostatic, hydrophobic, van der Waals interactions, no covalent bonds made, and show how higher order structure is built up within a cell. Okay, so this is the cytoskeleton. Now, if you take a mechanics course, what you'll find out is that a measure of stiffness, the material properties of protein, is that a protein has a Young's modulus on the order of a gigapascal. Okay? Now, gigapascal to you may not represent much, but just think of a hard plastic material like polystyrene. That has a Young's modulus of about a gigapascal as well. Yet, if you push on a cell, you'll find that its stiffness is on the order of a kilopascal. So something, even though it's made of protein, which are hard, the structures that those proteins assemble to is relatively soft. Now, what's the basis for that material property? Well, let's look at how structure and then now property of a material is built up from through self-assembly. This is an actin filament. It's a polymer of actin subunits. The subunits here are depicted as red, white, and blue just so that you could distinguish their positions in the polymer. So it's a linear filament. Protein subunits tend to add at one end of the polymer compared to the other, so it's polarized in its both in its structure and in its assembly. Now, the filament itself is organized into a higher level structure in the cell. This is an electron micrograph through the outer region of a cell, not much different than this. And what you can see is that there's a network or a mat of filaments. Now, this could look disorganized to you, and maybe it is at some level. But if we look in much more detail at discrete regions in this, you see that the filaments are organized in a very logical way, in that off of one filament is a branch, off of that filament is a branch, off of that filament is a branch. So each filament somehow gives rise to additional filaments through this branching process. That means that there must be some other protein which is starting this or nucleating the assembly of a branch. And then remember that filaments grow by adding at the ends. And if we look in this structure, we would see that the ends are certainly here in this structure. But if we were to look at all the ends, most of the ends, free ends in this meshwork actually lie at the outer regions of the cell. Now let's think back to what I told you about the assembly. Subunits add preferentially to one end, and it turns out that this end is the preferred end for assembly or addition of subunits. So imagine what happens in a cell. You have actin subunits that are adding to this end of the filament. Mass is conserved in the cell. So what must happen? You would see a translocation of the entire mass distally in this picture, or as you're seeing in this time-lapse movie of a cell, you're seeing mass being transported centripetally toward the nucleus of the cell. So what this movie is showing you is self-assembly in action, where it's capturing what we infer is assembly of subunits, addition of subunits at the end of these filaments. The entire mass of polymer, the network of filaments, are being are, in a sense, treadmilling its way or translocating its way to this part of the cell. If mass is conserved, you balance the equation of addition, and there must be subtraction, and you reuse the subunits. Okay? So this is, in fact, how we think cells move. It turns out that this cell is stuck to the glass coverslip by polylysine. The forces of adhesion are so strong that the cell can't move, right? But if you were to let this cell make and then break adhesions, then this translocation of subunits will then change its reference so that the membrane would then be pushed forward instead of the whole mass of polymer being pushed back. Okay, so this is on the order of nanonewtons of force. Addition of subunits at the end of each filament end by itself is on the order of a piconewton of force. Okay, self-assembly. Now, let's take that same example of self-assembly and let's look at a related but different system. Now, remember in the second lecture, I talked about how the genome, you know, there's 10 to the 13th cells in the human body. There's 10 to the 16th total cells during your lifetime. That means there must be on that order of cell divisions in which the entire contents of your genome must be faithfully and accurately replicated and then distributed to the daughter cells. That machinery for distribution of the chromosomes or the genome from one cell among two daughter cells is one of the functions of microtubules. Okay, so again, it's an element or component of the cytoskeleton of the cell, and it's the machinery that's responsible for doing a certain kind of work. What I'm going to tell you about is a little bit about the biochemistry and the cell biology of microtubules. It's something, again, you should have gotten in 701, also in 706, hopefully in 703 and 705, if you take biology. And then I'm going to tell you about how microtubule function in cell division can be used as a wedge or a handle at treating cancers, which are characterized by uncontrolled cell division, by use of drugs that are specifically designed or were discovered to act directly on the ability of microtubules to generate force. Okay, so it's a mechanics-based problem. Microtubules. We just saw what an actin filament is. It's a linear polymer. Here, a microtubule is composed of a heterodimer, or the subunit, the building block of the polymer, is a heterodimer of an alpha and a beta tubulin protein. Okay. They associate into a stable heterodimer, and that heterodimer, in some way that I'll show you later, adds in a way that you build up not a filament, but a tube. So this is a tube in the true sense. It has a hollow core, and it has a wall, which are composed of the microtubule or tubulin subunits. And we define that the subunits add in a polarized direction, and they add end on end. The wall of the microtubules are actually organized as protofilaments, which are linear strings of the tubulin subunit. Now, an important aspect of microtubule function has to do with mitosis. So here you see the genome condensing, the genome and chromosomes condensing, organizing during mitosis in the metaphase plate. And then now you're going to see the cell separate or partition the copies of DNA from one daughter cell and the other daughter cell. The cell will divide in half to form the daughter cells. Okay, that's basic cell biology. You must have gotten that in high school. Now, this is an experiment in which the microtubules in the cell are stained with either an antibody against tubulin, and the antibody is tagged with a fluorescent tag so that you can see this in the light fluorescence microscope. and in which the DNA or some component of the DNA is differentially tagged with a different dye. In this case, it could be a dye that stains DNA bases. Okay, so blue is DNA, green is microtubules, and what you see is that during the steps in which the chromosomes organize into the and are brought aligned into the metaphase plate and then separated, you find that the cell has a distribution of microtubules that seem random in some way. And then what the cell does is entirely disassemble its whole cohort of cytoplasmic microtubules and then reassembles them around the DNA or in order to organize the DNA. So you have now a bipolar structure. The bipolar structure then assembles microtubules between them. And then what happens is that there's a machine, the microtubules, again, are dynamic structures. That is, they're continually adding tubulin subunits to the ends of microtubules and taking tubulin subunits off of the opposite ends of microtubules. And so you see that you have a specialized microtubule structure or machine whose sole function is to organize the chromosomes and then distribute the chromosomes to daughter cells. And so here you have the what's called the mitotic spindle in anaphase, where literally the microtubules are pulling the chromosomes apart. How is that done? In several ways. One way involves this concept of flux or treadmilling of microtubule subunits through the polymer. So there's addition, preferential addition of microtubules at one end of the polymer. All the microtubules in the structure are organized in the same way, so they have a polarity that's uniform in the structure. Okay, so let me explain to you an experiment in which we can see, you can see this motion of material going from the center to the ends. This is the where the chromosomes lie. It's basically this picture on its side, and then with time you see a flux of material moving to opposite poles or ends of the structure. Now, why are we able to see this flux? Well, there was a technique or method developed called speckle microscopy in which you add a tubulin subunit which is tagged with a fluorescent dye. So you can see the microtubule in the microscope. However, if the entire microtubule was composed of this tagged tubulin subunit, the whole microtubule will appear as a line, a fluorescent line. The trick is, and if there's movement or flux among the subunits, you would never see it because there would be nothing to distinguish one part of a microtubule from the other. However, if you add the tubulin subunits that are fluorescently tagged at a very, very small relative amount compared to the amount of protein in the polymer, then you see that the microtubule will appear speckled if you were able to see it as an individual microtubule in the light microscope. So in contrast, instead of seeing a solid or contiguous line of fluorescence, you would see a discontiguous, maybe a line in fluorescence. Maybe you might not even be able to distinguish it as one microtubule because the labeling is so low. However, imagine, so that's why you see these speckles here instead of the lines of microtubules that we saw, for instance, in this picture. You know, in this picture, where you see the microtubules as linear objects. Okay, so here's the experiment. You just take a time-lapse movie like this, and for each frame, you physically box out one segment, which we show here as the chromosomes in green and the speckles that happen to be in that box. Now, what you see in the subsequent time frames is that the chromosomes basically stay in place. They're not moving during that in that interval. But notice what happens here. You see lines or traces of flux in which this speckle appears to be moving with time, in a direction that's opposite to the position of the chromosome. That is, you have a biradial flow of material from the chromosomes toward the poles of the mitotic apparatus. What that's telling you is that material is being added here, and that fiduciary marker on the microtubule is now moving out, implying that there's new material that's being added at the chromosomes during metaphase. So you see this as a flux or movement of material outward toward the pole at metaphase. So because there's a flux, it means that it's doing work. But in this case, the work is unproductive because the chromosomes are staying in place. It's as if you have a car engine in which the engine is revving up, but what the problem is that you don't have the clutch engaged, right? Now, what happens at the next stage is that the cell actually asks questions at a biochemical level and says, are all the chromosomes aligned? Are all the chromosomes attached to microtubules? Is everything else, you know, sort of okay? If so, yes, let's get started. And what happens is that there are proteins that keep the sister chromatids, or the pairs of chromosomes, physically together, and those bonds between those proteins break. These proteins are called cohesins, and they break. And if you take 703 from Professor Orr Weaver, her lab studies these cohesin proteins. So if the bonds between the chromosomes break, then obviously any force directed on the chromosomes is now transduced into the movement of the chromosomes. That's one part of it. You have to have the chromosomes separating, but also you have to get the flux of incorporation of microtubules at the chromosomes to be translated into a pulling force. And that requires another set of proteins which are designed that are on the chromosomes to actually latch on to the end of a chromosome, and then thereby being transported out as mitosis continues. Okay, so that's how you get chromosomes to the end. Once they're to the opposite poles, cells divide in half, you have two daughter cells. Mitosis is finished. Now, cancer, if you think about it, is basically a problem in unregulated cell division. Tumors grow because cells divide when they're not supposed to, in places that they're not supposed to, at times when they're not supposed to. So this whole process of cell division somehow goes awry. Also, the cells move to different places in the body and start tumors at different sites. So this is just a picture of some organ, probably liver, and you can see these different tumor masses in it. And at a histological level, in the light microscope, you can distinguish these blocks or aggregates of tumor cells from normal cells. So anti-cancer treatments are designed to kill tumor cells differentially. You don't want to kill normal cells. Or somehow control the properties of a tumor cell relative to a normal cell. Right? A tumor cell is not that much different than a normal cell. It's on the order of a few mutations in the genome that's being expressed. So where does microtubules come in? The seminal observation was about 25 or 35 years ago when Susan Horowitz's group discovered that a drug or a chemical compound that the National Cancer Institute had isolated and found to have anti-cancer properties or anti-tumor properties, and the structure is shown here, had an unusual property of causing the microtubules in a cell not to break down. So you can think of, you know, how do you disrupt mitosis? Well, if you can't form the structure in the first place, then obviously the cell can't divide. However, that's not what happened. If you look at these micrographs, where again you have chromosomes in blue and microtubules, in this case in red, you see that the cell is able to form microtubules, but in the presence of Taxol, you have committed the microtubules to assemble in such a way that you have disorganized the DNA. So here you have chromosomes at the poles instead of all at the metaphase plate. You have this aberrant kind of structure and so on. So there's unregulated assembly of microtubules. And the important property is that what they found was that this taxol binds and stabilizes the microtubules. So you prevent the dynamics from occurring. If the microtubules aren't dynamic, then from a mechanics point of view, it can't generate force. If it can't generate force, then there's nothing to separate the microtubule, the chromosomes. Okay, so this is a mechanic. You can think of this as a chemically based problem, but it really is, in fact, a mechanics based problem, i.e., why you're a bioengineer. Now, what is it of microtubule dynamics? We saw it in the time-lapse movie from the speckle microscopy. The basis for dynamics is that microtubules, like actin filaments, are polar in their structure. So one end is chemically different than the other end. Subunits add preferentially to one end or the other. So in this case, the preferred end of a microtubule, if we backtrack just 1 second, if we mark a set of microtubules, just say we can tag them with a dye or something, and then we watch how a microtubule grows, what we'll see is that on average, one end will grow longer than the other end. But also notice that there's a dynamic even to the assembly of microtubules in that they go through these cycles of assembly and disassembly. So that if you trace any one microtubule length, you'll see that it'll fluctuate over a large range of lengths with time because it's adding and subtracting subunits at both ends. Both ends are in dynamic flux, but one end is dominating over the other. So microtubules go like this. Well, actually, like this, right? Now, what happens when you add taxol? Taxol binds to the walls of the microtubule and somehow prevents this dynamic disassembly reaction from happening. So it's as if the taxol binds and glues the subunits together. What you see that is that as a microtubule, if a microtubule forms, it's likely to stay either its length or it may grow longer. Sometimes it may grow shorter, but it doesn't have the dynamic characteristic like a native microtubule would have. So taxol works at the molecular level by affecting how a microtubule breaks down. How does that work? Well, I gave you the clue before. This is a diagram of the wall of a microtubule. Taxol actually binds on the inside, and it in fact, is binding at a site in which it affects not only the microtubule it's bound, or its tubulin subunit that it's bound to, but also its neighbors. You could look at it, and you can actually envisage why it prevents disassembly. Right now, in this position, it seems as though it's acting to bind these subunits all together. Okay, so that's the interpretation of how taxol works. These happen to be the locations of where other drugs, anti-cancer drugs, work that are also targets, whose targets are microtubules. Colchicine is a compound which causes microtubules to break down instead of microtubules to be stable. And at very low concentrations, it also prevents the microtubule from being dynamic. There's a third drug called vinblastine. It's actually one of the earliest ones that were used, which binds solely to the ends of microtubules. Again, it affects the dynamics in much the same way that taxol does. Okay, so microtubules are the main structure of the protein machine that separates chromosomes. From the dynamics, you got a good idea, I hope, that it's also the part of the structure that's responsible for generating the motive force for separating chromosomes. So it's logical that a microtubule would be a target for treating cancer, because if you can control unregulated cell division, which happens faster than normal cell division, then maybe you have a wedge into controlling a tumor or the size of a tumor. And so these are current a table from the Jordan and Wilson review of the different drugs that are designed to act on microtubules and where they are in their clinical phase. Okay, so Taxol is a very important drug in cancer treatment. It's a very complex molecule. It's extracted from the yew tree, Pacific yew tree, which is not a very good source for the material. So the routes for making Taxol is through chemical synthesis. You can start from the base molecules and build up the synthesis, and that's, you know, like a 50-step synthesis. Or you can identify an intermediate, a naturally occurring intermediate, which you can use as a base, in which in a 4-step process you can then build up Taxol. And that's the economically favored route for synthesizing Taxol. As a bioengineer, you would think of other ways of synthesizing Taxol, maybe cloning all genes in Taxol synthesis pathway and having them, you know, generate or make Taxol in a bacterium or something like that. And that's actually a topic for a term paper that you can use. So the bioengineering aspect has to do with making Taxol. Taxol is insoluble, so you have to inject it with an oil to keep the solubility up. So, you know, you can engineer the molecule to also have better solubility properties and delivery properties. Let me just end by another application of Taxol. Now, it's used to control cell division. Let's think about stents and the operation of stents. When you go in and you basically scrub the wall of a blood vessel, you put in place this metal scaffold, which is designed to keep the wall open. However, one common problem is that the cells in the lining of this wall overgrow that scaffold and gradually grow back and block that vessel. So that's a bad thing. I'll just alert you to that Taxol, or one new development in stents, is to then coat them with drugs that are designed to knock down or to slow down cell growth around that stent. And of course, Taxol is one of those drugs that is embedded in a polymer that's designed to slowly release Taxol so that you do knock down or keep down cell growth, which is called restenosis. Okay, so that's an example where we understand the basic biology, we understand the technological applications, and a little bit of how engineering in the chemistry will get you from one to the other. Think about other examples how chemistry or engineering can help us with relating Taxol with cancer.